like the child's fire engines, we can say that some of the models are better than others. What makes a model better? It's a more faithful representation. It includes more elements. It's more intricate. It actually bears a stronger resemblance. Models are not, strictly speaking, true or false. Rather, they're better or worse. But we can develop understandings of a system from observing the simplified models. And the better the model, the more true the understanding is. Better models give us better explanations, a better understanding. The goal of science is to come up with increasingly better models. We can say that one model is better than another when it provides us with new insight into the system being modeled. Maybe this, then, is how we ought to think about truth in truth jokes. The jokes are not accurate descriptions of the thing being joked about, but rather can be thought of as a simplified model. Just as in a scientific model, we might leave out a huge number of variables to focus on the relations among just a couple. So too with a joke. We may pick out just one or two elements of the thing we're joking about to lampoon. Just as the simplified scientific model exaggerates the role of the variable programmed into it, so too the joke exaggerates the element focused upon. But they may actually have the relationships depicted. The reason we find the vegetarian joke funny is that while it exaggerates, people who make major lifestyle changes for moral reasons are, in fact, more likely to tell you about it. The more the change affects their lives, the more it makes them different, the more likely they are to mention it. The truth joke is funny because it's true. But what do we mean by true? Is it just a representation, or is it the case in the real world? Philosophy is the study that seeks truth, but can't even figure out what truth is. That seems both tragic and ironic. Interestingly, our next two conversations will discuss both tragedy and irony. And that is both true and ironic.
Lecture 5, Comedy and Tragedy.
So what's this one about?
The relation between comedy and tragedy.
Oh, are they different?
When I was single, I had blind dates that were both.
Nice. Oh, actually, I have a tragic joke for you.
Hit me.
Okay, so there's this guy. Loses everything. His job, his wife, his house, his friends, just everything. And the situation is so hopeless that he makes a decision to end it all. But he's been through so much pain already, he can't bear the thought of going through any more. So however he goes, it's got to be quick, it's got to be painless. And he racks his brain trying to think, how do I do this, and can't come up with it. He thinks to himself, well, somebody has to have cracked this at some point. And so he decides to go to the local library, goes up to the reference desk, asks, do you have any books on how to commit suicide? Librarian checks the computer. Oh, yes, actually we had one, but the last guy who checked it out never brought it back.
That's a great joke. I bet you kill with it every time you tell it. The old saying is that comedy is tragedy plus time. Along the same lines, some of the most widely quoted words in the literature of the philosophy of humor come from one of its earliest champions, the French philosopher Henri Bergson, who famously wrote that comedy requires a temporary anesthesia of the heart. Both of these notions seem to indicate that there's a deep connection between tragedy and comedy, that comedy seems to emerge out of tragedy. But at the same time, we often think of tragedy and comedy as opposites. Think of the very symbol of the theater, the drama masks. One is smiling, representing comedy, and the other is frowning, representing tragedy. Comedy is funny, tragedy is sad. They're opposite emotions, and the two forms of theater are intended to do opposite things. Tragedy, to oversimplify, is a play with a sad ending. Comedy is a play with a happy ending. They're only related by being at the far ends of the spectrum from each other. So, which is it? Does comedy emerge from tragedy, or is comedy the opposite of tragedy? What is the relationship between comedy and tragedy? That's what we want to discuss. Now, when we think of understanding comedy and tragedy, we start with classical Athens. The Greeks provided us with the image that we use to represent the theater, the smiling and frowning theatrical masks. These masks not only represent comedy and tragedy, but are the symbols of Melpomene and Thalia, two of the muses, the Greek goddesses of inspiration. There were nine muses, the daughters of Zeus, and Mnemosyne, the goddess of memory. The muses would visit the artist and grant them inspiration. Melpomene was the goddess of tragedy. Her younger sister Thalia was the goddess of comedy. So we see in the mythology of the Greeks a separation between the two forms. They have distinct goddesses looking over them, distinct means of inspiration. They were held to be distinct forms of art. This is reflected in the development of distinct formal structures for the two. In the great works of the Greek playwrights, we can see formalized plot elements that distinguish tragedies from comedies. These differences allowed for the creation of literary theory, and the person who developed the first theoretical approach to drama was Aristotle. His book, The Poetics, presented the first complete literary theory and comprised two books, that is, two sections. One was dedicated to working out a full understanding of tragedy, and the other a full understanding of comedy. One of the great tragedies of intellectual history is that only half the book has survived. We have the part dedicated to working out the notion of tragedy, but the second book, Aristotle's Theory of Comedy, is lost to time. No known copies have survived. What we do have are fragments of another work, referred to as the Tractatus Coisciliniensis, the Treatise on Comedy. This comes from a period later than Aristotle, but has been determined by scholars to be a commentary on the lost book two of Aristotle's Poetics. We don't have Aristotle's work, but we have someone who had a copy of the lost book of Aristotle commenting and arguing about it. The classical scholar Richard Janko studied book one and the fragments of this treatise on comedy and created what he believes is something close to what the lost Aristotelian book on comedy probably said. It's an exciting and ambitious work. Needless to say, many Aristotle scholars poo-poo the idea of channeling Aristotle. But I think it's an effort worth taking seriously, as long as you keep clear in your mind that you're dealing with an educated guess. So, let's look at Aristotle's take on the relation between tragedy and comedy. For Aristotle, tragedy must start with a hero. If bad things befall an undesirable person, then we think nothing of it. Maybe he deserved it. Bad things happen to bad people. There's a sense of justice there. But the key to a tragedy being truly tragic is that we must start by seeing the best in humanity before us. We root for the hero because the hero represents what's desired, appreciated, and sought in humans. This is an artistic representation of the people we think deserve to flourish in real life. But the hero's human, and to err is human. The hero oversteps his human bounds, and in an act of hubris, of pride, of overstating his greatness, of taking himself to be more than he is, the hero is brought down. The hero falls, likely dies. One false step, and the mighty is laid low. The representation of all we aspire to be ends up with a fate we fear and seek to avoid. The effect of tragedy on the audience is twofold, according to Aristotle. On the one hand, the representation of human greatness instills within us a sense of virtue. We learn from our desire to be like the staged representation of human perfection. But the tribulations of the hero fill us with fear, and the ultimate unfortunate destruction of the hero leaves us sad. We feel pity. We feel anguish. One might think the experience of these negative emotions would be a harm, but Aristotle says they're healthy. We truly experience these negative emotions because we have become so connected to the play, but we experience them within the safe space of a representation of life, not in life itself. At the end of the play, we leave the theater. We step out of our world of make-believe, and in doing so, we experience catharsis. That means we're cleansed of the feelings. We're purged of these negative emotions. We feel them, but then we let them go because it's not real life that caused them. And as a result, we're lighter, happier, and more humane. What of comedy? If tragedy requires a hero, comedy requires a clown, a caricature, a butt of the joke. Tragedies present us with a representation of human virtue, human greatness, human perfection that we aspire towards and admire. Comedy requires the opposite. It requires human flaws, and the more flawed, the funnier. Instead of a representation that exaggerates how great we can be, comedy begins with humanity at its ugliest, at its lowest, at its most basic level. The tragic hero speaks erudite words with perfect enunciation. The comic figure has an accent, either a foreign accent or the accent of a common person. He mispronounces words or says the wrong word when speaking, may be unnecessarily repetitive, or may speak complete nonsense. The way the fool speaks places him below us so that we may laugh down at him. The words of the tragic hero ring out like poetry, while the words of the comic figure have the lilt of song. The effect of the comedy is laughter. Laughter can be generated by the comic figures in two ways: things being different or things being alike. The first way, difference, is the representation of deception. Comic figures may lie or may be mistaken. On the one hand, we laugh when the morally corrupted comic figure pulls the wool over someone's eyes to cover up for something or to get away with something. On the other hand, we laugh at the comic figure when he's deceived. The clown may misunderstand how things are and act inappropriately, although from the standpoint of his understanding, it makes perfect sense. But since we know the truth, we laugh at the wrongheadedness of the mistaken fool. The second way laughter is generated, by making things alike, is through imitation. This can generate laughter in two ways: if the representation is apt or inapt. An apt representation of similarity, we laugh when we recognize the representation. If someone walks or talks exactly like someone else, we find it funny. We make fun of people by mimicking them. But there's inapt similarity as well. When the character mimicking another is very different, then the impersonation becomes humorous. If it's someone of low status passing himself off as someone of high status or the other way around, the effect is funny. When we laugh, Aristotle argues, we laugh at someone. There are buts to the jokes we enjoy. We're laughing at the foibles of others. This is not the nicest of ways to be. But unlike Aristotle's teacher Plato, who contended that enjoying such comedies were training us to be morally corrupted outside the theater in real life, Aristotle argues that comedy and tragedy share an effect. The result of the comedy is, again, catharsis. We're cleansed of our baser impulses. We release our flaws by engaging with them in the theater. Comedy and tragedy are different, according to Aristotle. They have different structural elements. They engage different emotional and moral aspects. But in the end, they share the effect of catharsis, leaving us purged of negative elements and ready to be better people in the real world. Now, not all philosophers agree with Aristotle. Aristotle sees tragedy and comedy as distinct forms. Other thinkers have argued that there is an interconnection between them. Arthur Asa Berger sees comedy as emerging as a reaction to a tragic world. Berger is a social scientist who has studied humor in general, but has a number of works where he looks at Jewish humor in particular. It's a common saying that Jews are a funny people because the history of Judaism is so tragic. Life has been so hard that the only way to survive it is to find humor in it. Berger generalizes this from the Jewish people to all people. He argues that the human condition is one in which we're born into lives of suffering. To suffer is to simply be human. We dread it, but we cannot avoid it. We are trapped in a world of accidents and misfortune. We can give into it, Or we can claim our autonomy by laughing at it, by finding humor in mistakes and unfortunate events. We transform ourselves into people more capable of flourishing in this life. Tragedy is when the tragic rules. Ultimately, in a tragedy, the hero dies. The hero opposes and succumbs to the tragic. But in comedy, someone merely becomes a fool. We can allow the evils of the world to claim us, or by laughing at them and at ourselves, we can reclaim ourselves, reclaim our humanity. Comedy emerges from the choice to see the tragic, not as tragic, but as absurd. We view ourselves as ridiculous figures, not as tragic ones. This comic way of being grants freedom to us. When you allow yourself to be a fool, you're no longer constrained by fear, by social convention, by aspirations and expectations. A dear old friend of mine was always fond of saying, "Don't worry about making a fool of yourself, it'll happen soon enough." That is Berger's sentiment as well. When you stop worrying about being ridiculous and embrace it, you've freed yourself from artificial social constraints, allowing you the space to become more fully yourself. The comic does not result in catharsis, Berger argues, counter to Aristotle. Rather, it results in cathexis, where the classical notion of catharsis is a purging of emotions leading to a necessarily positive resulting psychological state. Cathexis, a Freudian term, is the converse. It's an intentional seeking to well up great emotional energy for the sake of releasing it. For Freud, this could be positive or negative. That is, it could be an emotional cleansing, or it could be a problematic working oneself up. In the case of Berger's account of humor, however, it's a positive. Instead of Aristotelian catharsis, in which we feel our negative emotions in order to let them go, rather, we excite ourselves with comic energy, that is, life-affirming and celebratory. Humor is fun. It buoys us. In a world trying to beat us down, it gives us the boost to rise above. In this way, we see Berger, as well as other philosophers of humor like Lydia Amir and Simon Critchley, argue that humor comes from pain, that comedy develops out of tragedy. Comedy and tragedy are not distinct in content, just in how they allow us to view the tragic content of life. Let's return to the old saying that comedy is tragedy plus time. This is very much in line with this approach. The idea is that life involves suffering. We're all tragic heroes. That's the nature of being human. When we suffer, or at least soon after, the insult we suffer from life stings, and we can't see beyond the pain. But over time, the pain lessens. With the dissolution of the pain, we're able to step back, to adopt different perspectives through which to see the tragic events that befall us. From these new points of view, we can cast the tragic events in a light that shows them to be quite different. Not menacing, but perhaps absurd. We can recreate them in a way that brings out aspects we can exaggerate or connect to in things we never would have thought we would be connected to. And in this, we can derive humor from exactly that which had brought us pain. Humor develops out of tragedy, but it can't happen immediately. Comedy is tragedy plus time. There must be distance. There must be a buffer around it. We have to feel safe and secure, not threatened by the source of the tragedy and pain. When that boundary is transgressed, when someone tries to make humor from tragedy before the time is right, the attempt will fail. This is the infamous too soon phenomenon. How soon is too soon? We'll explore this question in greater detail for an entire lecture in the final third of the series. So for now, we can simply leave it as an open problem. But the point we want to take away is that there are two distinct views about the relation between comedy and tragedy. Aristotle argues that the comic and the tragic are different in form and content, but the same in effect. Contemporary thinkers argue that the comic and the tragic are different in form, but the same in content and different in effect. John Maral, the father of contemporary philosophy of humor, in his book, Comic Relief, A Comprehensive Philosophy of Humor, examines the tragedy-comedy distinction, but not purely in terms of definition. Moral notes that within the academic community, it's long been the case and continues to be that tragedy is taken to be not only emotionally serious, but intellectually serious. Comedy, on the other hand, is seen as light, as trivial, as intellectually vacuous. Because humor produces mirth, joy, and pleasure, it must be nothing but a set of shallow party tricks. Because comedy is not serious, there's no reason to take it seriously. On this view, there is a distinction to be drawn between comedy and tragedy, and the basis of the distinction, or perhaps a ramification of it, is that there's a difference in the intellectual value we attribute to them. We value tragedy as a tool for self-discovery, as a means of uncovering deep, eternal truths of the human condition, as a source of wisdom. Comedy is just a pleasant waste of time. Comedy is just entertainment, not possessing any deeper aspects or insights. Moral takes issue with this characterization. He wants to defend the value of comedy. He argues that comedy is at least as intellectually valuable as tragedy, if not more valuable. We may have gotten more value from tragedy when human life was different, but in the contemporary context, humor provides us with more value. Value, he argues, has to do with outcomes. If I want to say that something like medicine is valuable, then what I'm saying is that there's a job it does it well, and it's a job we want done. Illness is bad, we want it cured. Medicine does cure illness and does so effectively and efficiently. Therefore, we ought to value medicine. So, what of tragedy and comedy? The ancients were correct that these forms are representations of life from which we, one, leave with an emotional release, and two, come away with insights about how we ought to face challenges in real life. The theater gives us representations of life, and our viewing of them leaves us better or worse off when facing actual life. What does tragedy teach us? Tragic tales have a hero who embodies human virtues and who has to face tremendous obstacles. Learning how to deal with hardship and difficulty surely would be a valuable lesson. This is a job worth doing. So, how does tragedy say to do it? The tragic hero is a hero. That is, he's a fictional representation of human perfection. If something is perfect, it will not grow. It will not change. It will not develop. If a perfect human is faced with a superhuman task, there's one and only one virtue called for, perseverance. The hero must grind it out. The hero has to keep pushing on in the face of long odds. The hero will succeed only by not giving up. It's interesting that contemporary action films are tragedies stripped of the tragic. We put forward muscle-bound heroes who show no emotion and who rarely speak except to throw out a trite catchphrase, "Are you feeling lucky? Hasta la vista, baby," and the like. They're faced with a problem that no human could solve, but they end up solving it through the brute force of their will and physical strength. Our heroes save the day instead of dying. Their hubris is rewarded, not punished. We can be gods, is the lesson of our current non-tragic tragedies. But contemporary or classical, the idea is that what we leave the tragedy with is the sense that there is value in perseverance. To be better, we must have resolve, inner strength to face the challenges of life. But what about comedies? What happens there? Again, the comic characters are not heroic, but flawed. They're representations of common people. These imperfect individuals are again faced with challenges. And what happens? At first, they fail. They fail spectacularly. They fail in ways that are absurd, and we laugh at them. But comedies also have happy endings. How do we make it from failure to happy ending? It happens when the comic figure does something that can be considered to be absurd, but ends up being effective in helping a flawed individual overcome a major hurdle. The comic figure is creative. The comic figure is adaptive. The comic figure does not fight his way through. Rather, she has to think her way out of the situation by being clever, resourceful, and insightful. The comic figure has to figure it out. What happens in the plots of tragedies and comedies is reflected in the brains of the audience. What portions of the brain are triggered by the different genres? In the case of tragedies, it's the deep brain, the old brain, the animal brain. It's the section that are involved with anger, revenge, and action. You're being trained to single-mindedly stay the course. You're being trained not to think, but just do and keep doing. You leave the tragedy with your brain, trained to be a more simplistic being, incapable of seeing the world in a multifaceted, intricate fashion. But what does comedy do to our brain? The way humor works, we've seen, is to tie together multiple parts of the brain associated with higher functions. The brain on comedy is a brain more widely used. You're being trained to see the world in its complexity and appreciate the full, intricate, multifaceted nature of it. You're being trained to be creative, to look for innovative ways out or around your problems. You're being trained to accept yourself as limited, but becoming capable of overcoming your limitations through cleverness. Comedy encourages the individual to be rational, critical, and adaptive. In today's world, these are crucial elements of the well-formed moral character. As such, Moral wants to argue comedy is valuable, at least as valuable, and perhaps even more valuable than tragedy. There may have been a time for tragedy when culture was male-dominated and wars between cities or countries were a common feature of life. But in our world, we do not need to be trained to simply follow orders mindlessly and do so with one's full locked will. Rather, what we need are insightful, thoughtful, rational, and critical thinkers who can innovate and see the world from multiple angles. This is what comedy trains us to do. Comedy, Moral argues, is an essential element of contemporary culture. We learn from comedy. To not have comedy in life, that, he wants us to think, would be a tragedy.
Lecture 6, Irony and Truth.
Hey, Susan.
Hi, Steve. Still taping?
Indeed, indeed.
So what's this one going to be about?
Irony.
You do know the difference between the British and the American definition of irony, don't you?
Do tell.
Well, the British definition of irony is when the literal meaning of an utterance is at odds with the intended meaning. The American definition of irony is the property of being like iron.
Oh, Susan. Perhaps the place where humor and philosophy most strongly overlap is with the notion of irony. Philosophers from the very beginning of the discipline have seen the search for meaning and truth to be an ironic endeavor. Humor also is filled with irony. From the writers of classical comedies to contemporary stand-up comedians, irony has been one of the major tools employed in their craft. One could argue that it's irony that gives humor its philosophical importance. Now, there is ironic humor and non-ironic humor, but it's ironic humor that can be thought of as humor with philosophical content. Let us first understand what we mean by the term. It's slippery and gets used in different ways. Indeed, the most common usage of the term in current discourse is not what I mean in this lecture by irony at all. When we hear contemporary speakers use the word irony, what they often mean is a coincidence or synchronicity, right? Something's ironic on this definition if a desired goal is served or foiled by a happening that involved no intentional action on the part of the person whose goals are served or foiled by it. So, if I'm driving down the road and I hit a pothole and my tire blows out, I pull to the side of the road, not sure where to go, but I look up and it turns out that I'm right in front of a tire store, the new sense of the word would label this as ironic. Similarly, if we had been driving through a town and I had commented on how many tire stores there are in this town, but I hit the pothole outside of town when we're nowhere near a tire store, that too, on this newer account, would be labeled as ironic. Irony on this view is the hand of fate involving itself in a way that's helpful or harmful. Irony is seen as the universe being an active participant in helping or harming us. Again, this is the sense of irony you'll most often hear from today's speaker, but that's not how we want to use the word here. Unlike some, I don't want to say that these speakers are wrong in their use. Language is and will always be an evolving human tool. Words gain and lose meanings all the time. As Humpty Dumpty tells us in Through the Looking Glass, the real question is who is to be master, us or the words? I give humans the power and simply hold that irony can be a symbol with multiple meanings. But the meaning that will be important to us is the classical sense, in which what appears to be true turns out not to be. In irony, there will be a multiplicity of possible meanings of something, and someone holds a reasonable but false interpretation that gets corrected later on. In drama, for example, there are two main ways in which this could be employed. One is for the audience to know the truth, but a character not to know. It may be, for example, that we saw what was happening elsewhere because we watched the previous scene in which the character's wife told her lover that she was going to leave her husband and run away with him. And then in the next scene, we see the husband at work giving a long speech about how moral and devoted a wife he has, citing all sorts of evidence. The husband's monologue would be ironic. From the husband's limited point of view, he has good reason to believe in his wife's fidelity. But there's a disjointed relationship between reality and the appearance of reality from his limited perspective. Irony can also involve the inferences of the audience. A good playwright or screenwriter can provide us with scene after scene that leads us to form a particular opinion of what's happening in the fictional world, and then throw in one plot twist that forces us to completely reconstruct how we've understood the narrative. Oh, this was a front. He was the bad guy calling the shots the whole time. That is a creative use of this sense of irony. Suppose you rewatch the film or play, this time knowing the twist at the end. When you view the skewed truths of the character ultimately unmasked as the evil mastermind, statements that you had taken at face value and misinterpreted during the first viewing, you'll realize that they are, in fact, ironic. Yes, technically they're true, but what they really mean is something very different from what you thought they meant the first time. That is the sense of irony we will discuss here. Now, one could see easily how irony can be a tool for humor. Think of the standard architecture of a verbal joke, setup and punchline. Let's use this setup punchline joke as an example.
Hey. So a young lawyer just graduates from school and he's super excited to open up his first firm. And he's getting ready to get his first clients, and the secretary buzzes in over the intercom. Mr. Jones is here to see you. As the door opens, he picks up the phone, says, no, 10 million, not a penny less. If he offers less than 10 million, we're not dealing with him. That's an insult to our firm. Oh, Mr. Jones, welcome. So, tell me about your case. Sorry, I'm just here to connect the phone.
That is a joke based on irony. In this case, for the character and the audience. The setup is designed to lead you to interpret the situation in one way. There was a client coming in to see a lawyer, but then the punchline forces you to tear down and rebuild your understanding of the scenario. It's not a client with a legal case, but a workman helping to set up the office. In this instance, both you and the young lawyer had to reconstruct your understanding of the situation. But humor can be created where it's either one or the other. Irony figures significantly into humor. Not all humor is ironic, of course. There's plenty of just plain silliness, nonsense, or wordplay that's humorous, but in no way ironic. But a lot of humor does employ irony. If one tells the old chestnut, why did the chicken cross the road to get to the other side? There is no irony. But if you tell it at a KFC after being asked what pair of accompaniments you want with your two-piece white meal special, now there's irony. The same is true of philosophy. The goal of philosophy is to take a reader who lacks the truth and, by the end of the reading of the work of philosophy, to have the reader knowing the truth by employing rational steps which the unenlightened reader already believes. The reader will have a set of beliefs before the reading that lead to the conclusion that is not yet believed. You can see where this would be a situation rife with irony. Indeed, irony is where Western philosophy starts. The first momentous philosophical figure in our tradition is Plato, whose works depict Socrates engaging in philosophical discourse with a series of figures. The heart of these dialogues is Socratic irony. The irony is that Socrates, proclaimed by the gods to be the wisest in Athens, always claimed to know nothing. How could the person who knew the most know nothing? He was the only one who knew that he knew nothing. Does that mean he knew something? No, the irony. In almost all of Plato's works, we start with Socrates speaking with someone who thought he knew something. Socrates would ask him what he knew. He would respond, and the trap was set. You knew what was coming. The interlocutor would start with a claim that seemed to make sense. Socrates would ask a couple of questions to start clarifying the language. Then, more questions about the content of the claim. Ultimately, a contradiction would arise, and the interlocutor would be shown to be completely wrong. And the person who knew nothing would be shown to be the wiser of the two. That is Socratic irony. Philosophy and humor both strive to uncover hidden truth, uncover hidden meaning by getting you to see things in a new way that makes the mundane seem insightful. In this way, we see that there's a structural similarity between the two activities. Both of these are human activities that occur in places and at times. If you want to know what a culture finds funny, you have to know something about the culture. If you want to know what a culture believes to be the nature of truth and meaning, again, you need to know something about the culture. Both the humor and the philosophy that emerge at a place and at a time are informed by what the Germans call the Zeitgeist, the spirit of the times. As such, I want to argue that we see an interesting correlation between the philosophical movements of an era and the mode of ironic humor that are popular at that place and at that time. If we pick up with Plato and start in classical Greece, what we see philosophically is a divide between the imperfect and flawed world of appearances, the material world, and the true world of perfect, unchanging ideas. This is, of course, set out most famously by Plato in his masterwork, The Republic, in his Allegory of the Cave. Plato invites us to consider people trapped in a cave, chained to a wall, forced to look at nothing but the back of the cave. Behind the wall to which they're chained is a fire giving off light, and people walking with objects over their head between the fire and the back of the wall. The light from the fire hits the object, causing shadows to form on the wall. For their whole lives, the prisoners have seen nothing but shadows, so they believe that the shadows are real. Now, this is an allegory, a metaphor. According to Plato, the material world is just as false as shadows. Just as shadows are imperfect representations of the things causing the shadows, so too, material things in the world around us are imperfect representations of the real things. For Plato, what is real is what is perfect, and to be perfect is to be unchanging. All things strive to improve, and if something is already perfect, it will simply remain as it is. The perfect, and therefore the real, is the ideal. There's a realm of these ideas, what Plato calls the forms, and we can look into this world with the eye of our mind. When we use the eyes of our body, we see the shadows of the forms, imperfect, corruptible representations of the perfect ideas. But when we use the eye of the mind, we see the true thing itself. So, the human world is flawed. While there's a more perfect world beyond us, that is more perfect. We're led by our senses to what we believe to be knowledge and wisdom, but in the end, we're wrong about it. If you look at the ironic theater of the period, the structure is similar. There is a truth. The gods, or a chorus, know it. But the character does not. The character labors under a false belief and acts rationally given it. But, as the truth works its way out, the mistakes are the source of either comedy or tragedy. While there's irony in Greek comedy as well, perhaps the most famous example of irony in Greek theater is, of course, the tragedy of Oedipus the King. Throughout the story, there are many points at which a character, be it Oedipus's father or Oedipus himself, acts with incomplete information, figuring the acts to be rational, which they would be in normal circumstances. But, of course, the circumstances are not normal, and the truth shows the acts to be problematic after the fact. Of course, Oedipus learns the hard way that such peculiar circumstances are something that he would need to keep an eye out for. But the point for us is that the nature of the irony in both philosophy and theater come from the same worldview. Irony is the result of coming to see how things are not as you thought they were, and this requires having a sense of how things really are. For the Greeks, both philosophically and artistically, how things are is a matter for the gods. Gods whose actions are often capricious, sometimes immoral. Unlike the perfectly rational God of the Renaissance Christians and the Enlightenment deists, whose will and acts are open to absolute deduction using pure reason, for the classical Greeks, relying on the false but rational results of the human mind will lead to misunderstandings and tragic or comic consequences. Philosophically, we see this view maintained for quite a while, up until the scientific revolution that ushered in the philosophical movement known as the Enlightenment. Before that, the change was made from the polytheistic approach of the Greeks and Romans to the monotheistic Judeo-Christian God, but the view of truth remained the same, and the irony in philosophy and humor remained the same as well. But with the Enlightenment, things changed. Now, an all-perfect God would be a perfectly rational God, whose creation would have to be perfectly rational. God's plan was available to human knowledge as long as the mind was employed properly. With this change in philosophical approach to truth and meaning, we see a corresponding change with the ironic humor presented. Now we see the target of the ironic humor being flawed humans who act irrationally. Anthony Ashley Cooper, the third Earl of Shaftesbury, about whom we'll talk in later discussions, contends that humor is a test of truth. That is, we only laugh at mistakes. If something's correct, it isn't funny. Humor, especially ironic humor, is the result of exposing human error. And so we see the ironic comedies like those of Molière. We laugh at the foibles of Molière's characters because they try to be rational but fail. They puff themselves up to be greater than they are, and when the truth of their limitedness is exposed, or when it's not yet exposed to the other characters but known to the audience, we find the situation uproariously funny. Consider Tartuffe, for example. In this masterpiece, the wealthy Orgon and Elmira have fallen under the sway of the slimy preacher Tartuffe. The play is funny because it's known to the audience that Tartuffe is a con man, a fraud, who's able to make people believe that which is false. We see his victim, Orgon, believing the lies and therefore ending up in bizarre circumstances in which he acts strangely all the time, thinking himself perfectly rational. Yet, despite all the irrationality, it ends up a happy ending for Orgon. It's as if he took a long trip and made so many wrong turns that he ended up actually reaching his destination. Truth in the Enlightenment comes from the proper application of the rational faculties of the human mind to the perfectly rational designed universe. Irony, then, would be the result of applying reason properly to that which has formerly been thought about improperly. The sudden uncovering of human mistake and error leads to its correction. In this way, we find irony in both philosophy and humor. In overturning a long-held prejudice, for example, we take that which was taken to be necessarily true and expose it as necessarily false, yielding philosophical irony. Something similar can be seen in the comedy of the period. Now, the 19th century saw a revolt against the thoroughgoing rationalism of the Enlightenment in both philosophical and artistic quarters. The elevation of reason by the Enlightenment had depressed the place of the passions. To reduce humans to their mind and ignore their heart was to impoverish us to the point of losing what it is to live a truly human life. Truths are felt, not just deductively derived. We're emotional beings, not rational calculators. As such, the notion of truth underwent a radical revision. The Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, for example, argue that there are indeed rational truths for the human mind to discover. But there are irrational ones as well. The human mind must move beyond the rational if it wants to access the higher truths of being. Saints Anselm and Aquinas may have believed that we could create absolutely sound rational arguments that demonstrated the existence of God. But Kierkegaard thought that belief in the existence of God was irrational. Not wrong, just something that required faith beyond reason. God was outside of the realm of the rational, and belief in God required a leap of faith. That leap is over an abyss of doubt, which cannot be overcome using the reason. It simply cannot. Kierkegaard follows Friedrich Hegel in arguing that the universe will necessarily include contradictions. To the Enlightenment logical minds, contradictions had to be rejected. They were necessarily false. But to Hegel, Kierkegaard, and a number of other Romantic era thinkers, the principle of non-contradiction that sits at the foundation of logic should be abandoned. Overthrowing logic does not destroy the world. It frees the human spirit. Embracing the contradictory is the key to transcending the limitations of reason. For Kierkegaard, this understanding of the contradictory nature of the world around us is to be called nothing other than irony. Irony, the exposure of the real truth that was hiding from our reason, is a necessary step in the evolution of the human mind towards the higher truths of being. Similarly, we see irony in the 19th and early 20th century making a similar move. At the start of the period, we see the celebration of nonsense in Lewis Carroll's Alice stories and the works of Oscar Wilde. Irony abounds. But the source of the irony is far from a celebration of the emotional side of the human being. In Wilde's classic, The Importance of Being Earnest, the humor comes about because people were forced to maintain social masks of respectability, to obey bourgeois rules of etiquette, which presented false but refined and flattened pictures of them. All the while, behind the masks were real people with plans and emotions. The ironic humor emerges when the socially required masks, the falsely created pretend truth, is stripped away to reveal the real human, passionate, emotional beings underneath. Then came the 20th century. In the 20th century, from the mass killing of troops in the trenches of World War I, to the use of poisonous gas, to the Holocaust, to the threat of global annihilation, from nuclear weapons, to the destruction of faith in the moral uprightness of global leaders, any firm foundation on which one could base the meaningfulness of life was blown to bits. Meaning and truth, with a capital M and capital T, were no longer ideals capable of being maintained. The universe had lost its moorings. Physics was relativistic, and so too seemed everything else. Absolute space, God, the divine right of kings, everything that had grounded us for millennia, gone. The end of the 19th century, start of the 20th, replaced the objectivity of the Enlightenment with the subjectivity of the Romantics. The middle of the 20th century moved the scientific worldview beyond merely using reason to gain truth. Now we were to be transformed as humans by science. It was better living through chemistry, a technologically controlled future in which our machines became thoroughly embedded in our being. The Jetsons were not merely a comedy, but an attempt to show what we were picturing the future to actually be like. Philosophically, one reaction to this new technological life was postmodernism. The core of postmodernism is the rejection of any grand narratives, of any concepts capable of making absolute sense of the world. Truth is a matter of interpretation, and interpretation is a function of politics. Everything is politics. Power relations are what determine what you believe. If you hold power, you get to create the categories through which the world is created. But those in the out-group, those who have little or no power, are capable of creating their own worlds in which to live. So, if irony is exposing the truth through falsity, and there is no truth, does that make irony impossible or ubiquitous? They have their own truth, just as you have yours and I have mine. We cannot absolutely justify any belief, but we can deconstruct them. That is, peel back the layers of presuppositions supporting them, not to see if they're really true or not, but to expose the politics that gave rise to the belief. We can tell the political story of how we came to believe it, but there's nothing beneath it other than that. And that story could be told in any number of ways from any number of perspectives. This contemporary nihilism, again, was not just present in philosophy, but made its way into both highbrow and popular culture. Whether it was the novels of Philip Roth or on the television show Seinfeld, the ironic humor of the times pointed to the meaninglessness of life. Seinfeld was a cultural phenomenon and was famously described as a show about nothing. The show went nowhere. There was no character development, no growth, no very special episodes where a narrative arc took an unexpected turn. That was exactly the point. Life is a series of mundane occurrences that seem so important to us at the moment when we're experiencing them, but which are, in the grand scheme, meaningless. It means nothing whether we get the soup or not. If George or Elaine loses a job, Jerry breaks up with a girlfriend, or Kramer has a brilliant idea in this episode. There's another job, another girlfriend, another idea in the next. Nothingness was itself the basis of the most popular vehicle for humor. Consider a series of books a decade and a half earlier. Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series, a hugely best-selling series whose central plot device was the search for meaning. The search for the answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything turns out to be meaningless. 42. You have the answer, but you can't have the question. Or you can have the question, but can't have the answer. The ironic humor of the late 20th century, like some of the most prominent philosophy of that period, held that there is no real meaning to life. Irony is the exposure of truth through falsehood. But in the 20th century, the ironic twist was that there really wasn't any truth to be exposed despite our deep longing and concerted effort to find it. We held out hope against hope that there would be. We seemed to be on the scientific and technological path to finding it. But then, poof, it was all gone. Life is unmasked to be pointless, meaningless, vacuous. The nature of irony is to expose truth and meaning. At different times, we've held very different accounts of what life means and what truth is, what truths can be found, and how to go about finding them. In each of these periods, it's the philosophers who lead the way in making prescriptions about these matters. Those philosophical works permeate the culture. Humor is a product of the culture, and thus the philosophical approaches to meaning and truth will be contained within the humor. As such, what we see is irony giving meaning to humor. Ironic humor is that which uncovers a truth that had previously been hidden. As such, humor can only be ironic if it does, in fact, contain some truth or meaning. Now, not all humor does, of course. Some humor's not deep, just fun. There's nothing wrong with the enjoyment of it. But some humor is deep. Some humor does contain truth. Some humor is meaningful. This humor is ironic humor. The irony in humor provides the philosophical depth that can be found within it. Humor can be silly, but it can also be profound. And that profundity is sometimes the result of irony.
Lecture 7. Satires, parodies, and spoofs.
Okay. So, what's today's topic, Steve?
Satire.
Satire?
Indeed.
Oh, well then. Today, we are examining satire. Satire is when you have a wheel that is very unhappy. Therefore, that's what makes it a satire.
You want the coat and tie?
Well, you get a free bowl of soup with that? Ha! Oh!
Humor's long been a neglected subject of serious discussion because it's thought to be light, fun, and silly. But there's a corner of the humor world that takes itself very seriously. Satire. Satirists are the political activists of the comedy world. The very point of satire is political, to point to parts of one's social context that are out of whack and to use humor to expose the need for change. Satire is one place where humor is taken very seriously. The term satire comes from two very different sources, one Greek and one Roman. The difference between these is a split that we will see has continued to run through the theory of satire from classical Rome to today. The Greek origin of satire traces to satyr plays. We've already looked at the two main categories of drama in classical Greece, tragedies and comedies. But there was a third category, satyr plays. The satyrs were mythological creatures with largely human bodies, although the ears and tails of a horse. They were the companions of Dionysus, the Greek god of wine. The satyrs were infamous for their insatiable pursuit of bodily pleasure with women. The annual festival celebration of Dionysus featured drinking, merriment, and lots of theater. A series of three tragedies would be performed, but the final play would be a satyr play. Satyr plays in the park. You'd think it was the 4th of July. People laughing, really laughing. A man selling ice cream, singing for a song. Satyr plays featured elements of both tragedy and comedy. But the chorus would dress up as satyrs and engage in all sorts of bawdy antics. The satyr plays would be ripe with innuendo, dirty jokes, and pranks. These plays would often poke fun at prominent figures in local life in ways that would never be appropriate outside of a celebration for Dionysus. When we develop our modern word for what the figures who are caricatured in the satyr plays went through, we came to call it being satirized. So, the first sense of satire, rowdy, bawdy imitations designed to have an audience laugh at someone, comes from the Greek satyr plays. This is one branch of satire. The Romans were infamous for appropriating elements of Greek culture and claiming them for their own. But when the great Roman satirist Quintilian declared that satire is an entirely Roman form of literature, he was not covering up for cultural theft. The Roman concept of satire is indeed particularly Roman and different in origin from the Greek. The term satire also has a Latin etymology. It's an English transliteration of the Latin phrase lanx satura, which translates to full bowl and refers to a bowl that Romans would keep on their tables filled with fruits and nuts. Satire is the dessert of the literary world, the sweet and satisfying treat you take when you want a tasty snack. The Latin satires were not lewd affairs for gathered masses of drunks. The writers of classical satire in Rome were more intellectual, if not more restrained, in their approach, and conformed their works to precise poetical forms. Roman writers not only wrote satires, they wrote about satire. The form was of such importance to the literary scene of classical Rome that great thinkers devoted time arguing about the nature and purpose of satire, about how satire ought to be written, what tone is necessary. As always happens in philosophy, they didn't agree. The two major figures in this debate were two of the great satirists of the time, Quintus Horatius Flaccus, better known as Horace, and Decimus Junius Juvenalius, better known in English as Juvenal. While these two towering figures disagreed vehemently, it's important to start from the core of the matter about which they agreed. They both agree that satire is, one, a work of fiction. Two, a work that refers to real life. Three, it's intended to be humorous. And four, its humor derives from pointing out flaws in the real life elements it portrays. Satire is, for both of them, an inherently moral activity. We live in an imperfect world. We need to act to perfect it. Satire is a tool in this process of the betterment of culture. The use of the tool is to point out the aspects of society that require fixing. All of this is accepted by both sides of the debate. The argument is over how satire ought to perform its socially necessary task. Horace contends that satire has to have a softer side. The point of satire is to help us correct flaws.